Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Most people believe they get interrupted because that is simply how the interrupting person behaves. In reality, the blame more often lies with the speaker rather than the interrupter. Your listeners may be interrupting you because you take too long to get to the point or because you never pause to let them get a word in edgewise. Stacey Hanks, author of the new book, Influence Redefined, is here to tell us more. Stacey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's an honor. Thanks for the opportunity.
We say here, the listeners, they don't interrupt us. They send us nasty emails occasionally when we do get too verbose. But tell us what is the basis. First, tell us a little bit about yourself. Then tell us a little bit about your book and your website. And then the first question is, how do you encourage people to interrupt yourself?
You bet. So the company, Stacey Hanke Inc., we're 15 years old this year. And I keep saying we because I've got a team that supports what I do and instructors that go out to corporations and deliver workshops, mostly for directors to the C-suite. I started my career out actually in radio, and I wanted to be the next Katie Couric, but that apparently did not happen. But I found a real knack for this whole idea of just because we communicate a message doesn't mean people understand it. And I've just really spent the last 4 years writing book number two, Influence Redefined. I spent 4 years doing it because I really wanted to figure it out. Why do some people have influence and others don't? So based on a lot of interviews with top influencers and quite a bit of research, that book came to life. And that book really is the core to the work that I do through mentoring, through a lot of keynote presentations, as well as my team. Part of the book, there's a big piece where we've done research around this whole idea of interruption because a lot of our clients would always argue with us saying, well, it's the listener's fault. That's why I'm getting interrupted. In the book, I talk about how if you're getting interrupted, and it's a pattern, like it's happening enough for you to say, all right, what's happening? Here's what research shows why most people get interrupted. We say too much. We have a lot of extra, what I call filler words. Therefore, we start speaking in paragraphs rather than sentences. That takes us a long time to get to the point. All of those reasons combined together, your listener gets frustrated. When your listener gets frustrated because we especially talking to directors, to the C-suite, we don't have time. They don't have time. They're looking for individuals who have courage and confidence to get to the point quickly.
Well, that's a great starting point. Now I'll turn it over to Dan.
I have to ask you a personal question that Don and I experienced recently. We were asked to be guests on a television program where there were two conservatives and two liberals. Don and I were the conservatives.
Okay.
And the host of the program was asking a question to each group. And so Don said, well, we'll let the liberals go first. So we sat there as good, polite citizens. We let them answer the question. Then he turned to us and he asked us the question. Within 2 minutes of me answering the question, both of the other two started to interrupt to get their opinion back in again.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do when you're in a situation where, and I believe it's a, if you look at it, it's a democratic strategy because it's everywhere.
Sure. sure.
So how do you help us, Don and I, to deal with that?
I think you have to listen really behind. What are they? Are they interrupting on your topic? Are they interrupting on another topic because they want to go in a different direction? I talk about in the book how if you truly are speaking in short bullet point sentences, you're getting to the point, you're not wasting anyone's time, and you still get interrupted, that really is a gift. Because one of the differences between someone who's a good communicator versus someone who's influential Monday to Monday is this ability to adapt the message on the fly, making sure that what you're saying is truly resonating with your listeners for you to have a discussion rather than what leads into a conflict situation or a disagreement. And you get interrupted, it's really listening for what are they really interrupting? Are they interrupting what you're saying? Or are they interrupting because they want to take the conversation to a different place? So that's step one. Step two, if they want to take the conversation to a different place, going with your instinct on asking yourself, all right, if I go there, it's completely going to derail the conversation and the point I'm trying to make, or do I finish where I'm at and then go to where they want me to take them? And if it's option two, I've said to my clients, I'm going to wrap up where I was in the midst of or what I was in the midst of sharing with you, and then that will lead me to exactly where you're going. And you feel there's a little bit of a benefit in it in that comment to your listener based on what you're saying. Sometimes the interrupter just wants to be heard. And once they know that you really are listening to what they're saying and you're not caught up in your direction, what you want to communicate, I find they start to back down.
Mm. I wish I could agree with you.
I said to the two gentlemen, excuse me, we politely listened to what you had to say, and we didn't interrupt you. Please extend to us the same courtesy that we extended to you.
Mm-hmm.
They ignored them.
Right, because I think, you know, depending, I'm not there on the call, right? So I'm going off of just what I know and what I've experienced. That comment, if they ignored it, that communicates to me they didn't feel like they were being heard. Even though you said that, I think they wanted to be heard on what was it that they actually interrupted you on. Was it a topic they felt like, no, we need to address it now, we need to go that direction? Changing your response to the interrupter to make sure that there's a benefit in it for them to, hey, this is why, let us talk so that we can go down that direction. And sometimes it's just a matter of, it sounds like we're both on two different topics right now. Let's us go back to where we were going to direct the conversation, and that way we'll make sure we also save you time. Now, I just threw out two benefits just as an example, is save you time, make sure that you get value.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so much about our communication. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, it seems to me, Stacey, in that particular instance, the other two people didn't want us to talk or to put our points across, but rather to drown us out. They weren't there to hear us. They were there to advance their point of view and to drown out what we were saying. And how do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm. If that truly is the case, then I'll say we want to make sure that our listeners get both sides of the point of view. We appreciate the fact that you've now shared your piece. Let us take a turn, and then we'll come back to where we left off. Again, just an example. Now, you hear in the tone of my voice, I'm not fighting it. I never interrupt back, because I really find that how we behave is how people respond. If they truly wanted to get underneath your skin, and I don't know if this is the case, if it did come across that they did get underneath your skin, oh, they're going to jump all over that. That is, you know, their win there. My father always said to me, you know, don't play to the games. Stand your own. Always honor and have courage to what you're saying and why you're saying it. And it's hard for people to back down from that.
So let's move away from Don and I, and let's deal with our listeners. We clearly have in our country today significant polarization, and in any given corporation today, you could have some significant variations in thought about what the company should do and shouldn't do, and management is really, it's management's responsibility, at least I believe it is, to manage the conflict within the company.
Mm-hmm.
So what advice would you do, would you give to a president or an owner of a small business where he sees conflict within his employees about what is the direction of the company? How does he insert himself and at the same time not feel like he's degrading either side of the issue?
He has to be, he or she needs to be very clear, concise, put a lot of thought and planning into every word that they address. I think that is a big mistake that most people do, and they cannot be silent. They need to over-communicate what's happening, because conflict increases when the communication is vague or the communication is not frequent enough. We all know that employees start to create their own message in their head when things start to get silent. I would also make sure that if I was at CEO and I do this on my team, is I want to make sure I really understand all sides of the story, that I go out and I fetch those sides of the story. I find that that line of communication, if the CEO is getting messages around what is really the cause, the issue behind the conflict in the company, if that's coming from a variety of different individuals, by the time that message gets to him or her, it's diluted, and there might not be truth to it. I talk a lot about in the book about honest feedback, which I think takes a lot of courage. And honest feedback is a CEO who can stand in front of his or her company and talk about what's the bad, the ugly, what's the current state, the situation, and then at least having some ideas around what that solution is. And if they don't have an idea around that solution, being honest up front with that piece too. I really believe, even though that day in, day out, there's always bad news, right? That's just part of running a company. There's conflict. It's going to happen. The conflict, though, gets out of hand when you've got a CEO that's just not upfront and honest and comes across that way, that what he or she is saying truly is a consistent message to how he or she is delivering that message.
Well, Dan, can I jump in here and throw Stacy another controversial? We're facing many dilemmas involving sexual harassment of various sorts. And as someone once told me, sexual harassment sometimes is misinterpreting words. Do you have any advice? I know a lot of companies are looking for for people to help them through this very difficult situation.
I think some of this is out of my repertoire, right? I think there's a lot of HR issues. I know from my past experience that there's not clarity on what is how they're going to handle it in the first place. I think too many companies avoid it or pretend that it's not going to happen. Tying back to where you started, though, that question is where I thought you were going. It's the clarity again. There's this misperception that just because we convey a message, it's understood and it's heard. There's so many misperceptions around that, especially if it's coming through an email, it's coming through a tweet, or sometimes it's coming through several different individuals communicating that point. Go back to the basics. As a company, go back to the basics and make sure that your policies, your procedures, everything is really, really clear. Number two, whoever is communicating the message, this is basic 101, make sure that what you say is communicated in a way that who you're trying to influence, who you're trying to get to act on what you're saying, truly does understand you. I think there's a lot of miscommunication around our messaging because it's not clear. We don't know how to communicate effectively, not only during our words, but also through our body language. And once those two are not consistent, or there's guesses around, well, I heard them say this, but it came across this way, that's, I think, where we all get into trouble. You know, we can see that in our media, how many times, and whatever the issue may be, and you're watching a story on media, it'll start small, and before you know it, it's turned into this huge story, but sometimes the truth doesn't come out till later.
If ever.
Now, if ever, no. Exactly it, yes. How many of our leaders have gotten into trouble because of what they've communicated? maybe it's a matter of get back to the basics. And someone said to me after I got done delivering a keynote the other day, he came up to me after he participated in my session, and he said, "Are you recommending that we think before we speak?" And I laughed, and I said, "Yes. We need to think before not only we speak, we need to think before we communicate or choose the medium that we're going to communicate the message through."
Well, you know, Stacy, I was just listening to what you said, and sometimes, not that I'm a fan, I thought it was an interesting observation. Jimmy Carter over the weekend said that the treatment of Donald Trump by the American media and what they're saying about him is the worst that he's ever seen or can recall in his entire life, and question the validity of what they were saying. You know, and I'm looking at it and saying, wait a minute, I understand what Mr. Carter's saying, but it's really representational of our society. We have people. When I was running a product area for Merrill Lynch, they knew I was going to be doing a lot of public speaking and a meeting with the press, and they sent me to a school to train me to how to deal with the press. And I would do interviews, fake interviews, and then the reporters would write a story, and then they would say, "This is what we're going to write about you." And it wasn't anything that I said. It's just they said it, and because they said it, they were allowed to get away with it. And so it helped me to be a little bit more guarded, if you would, if that's the right word, thinking about what I'm saying before I say it. Yet I'm convinced now in my consulting practice, there are a lot of people who have become successful almost in spite of themselves. And as they've taken on more responsibility within a company, the company may not have necessarily given them the tools to be a more effective communicator to a larger audience.
That's it. And I hear it all the time. I get an executive one-on-one with me, and it all comes out, the truth. And a lot of times executives will say to me, "I've never gotten the feedback." A lot of times everyone tells me how good I am. "I've never seen myself on video playback or audio playback. Therefore, I'm just going off of what everyone tells me. But now I've reached this point where I want to be better. I want to make sure that my reputation that precedes me every day is one that I'm proud of." And that's usually when they come to me. And it goes back to this misperception of, well, your level of influence and your level of effective communication, that comes with your years of experience and your title. It could not be farther from the truth. Influence is not a badge of honor you suddenly achieve. It is becoming even harder to achieve because there's more competition out there. We live in a whole new world of work called noise. What are you going to do? How are you going to communicate? How are you going to make someone feel in that conversation to make sure you stand out from the noise? It's a lot, all of these items, it makes it a lot more difficult to have influence, to be an effective communicator.
I'm trying to help our audience, and I've got this wonderful person like you that has a lot of experience. Are there a couple of real basic, simple tips that you can give to our audience today that might help new executives, growing executives, to become more effective communicators?
Yeah, three, right on top of my head, feedback. But I'm not talking good, nice job, that's not feedback. But I'm talking prepared feedback. They really need to find people that they can trust that prior to a meeting, conversation, presentation, whatever it may be, to say to that individual, "Here's what I'm working on. Here's how I want to come across. Would you pay attention to that in my verbal and also my nonverbal behavior?" And then after that interaction, make sure you get that feedback, and then you put action steps around it. That's absolutely essential. We don't get feedback, and we go off of what we believe to be true rather than what's fact. The second,
but let me go back to one. So, what I have to, and I'm phrasing it a little differently than what you said.
Mm-hmm. That's okay.
What I heard you say was, find somebody you can trust to be honest with you, to give you a fair and honest critique of what it is you're trying to do.
Yes.
Isn't that awful hard to do today?
I don't think so. No, I don't think it is, because it's not just – here's the difference. I'm giving people the how-tos of how to prepare the feedback, what we do, most of us, is after an interaction, or let's say a presentation, we'll go to someone and we'll say, how did I do? Well, they don't even know what you want them to give you feedback on. And most likely they take the easy way out and they're going to say it was good. And then we walk around life saying everyone's good, everything's good. I find when I prepare the feedback, when I set someone up with, here's what I'm working on, would you listen for this? Tell me when I do it. And this is how I want to come across. Would you listen for that and let me know when does that happen? And when you give someone direction, now they've got action to actually come back with you on. I think feedback is absolutely critical. The second
okay,
one
number two.
Is deliberate practice. Notice the word deliberate. Most of the time we practice what we're already good at. And if you think about how many times you've communicated already today, all of those interactions were opportunity to practice improving not only your verbal communication, but your nonverbal communication. We just don't consciously do it. Instead, we go through our day, meeting after meeting, shooting email off after email, and we don't give thought to, well, how is that coming across, and what's the chance someone's going to respond the way we want them to respond? The third one is huge, and that is on a regular basis, several times a week, several times a month, video and audio record yourself. That will be a make or break in anyone's career. To be able to experience yourself through the eyes and ears of your listeners is a lot different than believing how you feel determines the level of influence you have.
Stacey,
I can remember,
speaking about your last one, I can remember the first time I did a radio show. I did it on tape first, and I said, and I played it back, and I said, oh, my God, I'm terrible. Nobody will listen. I can't even listen. I can't even listen to me.
Exactly.
And, yeah, and you're right. And I do, because I do a lot of radio and television both, I have that sense of practice many times a week. But it's true. We never really know how we sound because we don't really listen to ourselves. And I'll give you a little tip to give to your audience.
Please.
That I use a long time. If you take your index finger and you press it on your earlobe and press it in, you can hear yourself talk. You don't need a recording studio. You don't need a microphone. You can actually hear yourself talk. The resonance through the bone in your head. So
that's a good tip.
That's
Thank
the way,
you.
No matter where you are, 24 hours a day, if you're driving in the car, stick your finger and close the ear, and you can actually hear what you sound like. And you can say, I need to work on my pace or work on my tone or articulation or whatever. So it's something you could do all the time.
I want to go back a little bit and ask you, we originally talked about when you're making a speech, to me the worst thing in the world is watching three or four people in the back that start talking to each other and two or three in the front that start to sleep. How do you get them to re-engage with you?
Don't let them disengage to begin with. So, again, really speaking from experience, I believe this because I look at my career when I would have side conversations in front of me and the sleepers, and I couldn't figure out what is it, and I would talk louder and faster. I would torture them even more, being totally clueless until I video recorded myself and realized, No wonder they're getting distracted. It's because of me. What I share in the book, it's more towards the end of the book. There's two skills, delivery skills in particular, that I pound with clients. I talk a lot about look people dead in the eye for a full sentence or thought. Only speak when you see eyes. When you look people dead in the eyes and you do that the minute you start speaking, you're connecting and engaging. People see that. And a lot of my audiences will always tell me, well, we didn't want to go on our technical gadgets because we could tell you could see us. And that's a lot different than just scanning the audience or talking to your PowerPoint slides, whatever it may be. The sleepers probably are falling asleep if it's not engaging and it's not interesting and impactful. And even if you're still, you could be doing jumping jacks and it's not working, get them involved. make the presentation not about you. Make the presentation a two-way conversation where your listeners really feel like they're getting involved, you're getting them involved, the message is about them and not you. You tie those two together, those three together. Another one is pausing. When the speaker is saying too much and it's only word after word after word, no breaks, no opportunity for the listener to catch up, the distractions, the disengagement will also occur.
Well, one more quick question on that. I think you're absolutely right. But what about what I call the front row shooter? The guy that, or it's usually a man, seldom a woman, who shouts question after question at you, trying to disrupt your approach. And worse yet, does that at a meeting. How do you handle that?
Mm-hmm. I go with my instinct. If the questions truly are legit, I'm definitely going to answer them. I also, when I answer a question, no matter who the person is, avoid keeping your eyes only on them, because now it's this back and forth and you're feeding it. So I'll start by giving that person, the questioner, one sentence by looking at them, and then I get my eyes off of them and I start sharing the question with everyone. I still check back in with the questioner. I also don't end my eyes on that questioner if I can tell they're really pushing. So you can see just that nonverbal, how that's going to break some of that. If this questioner, I do those skills and they still keep going at me, I need to go with my instinct because I still have other people in the room that I need to take care of. I need to make sure that they're getting value out of this conversation. At some point, I think it's completely legit to say to this individual, you have a lot of questions, a lot that you want to bring to the table. I want to make sure that we honor our time and we don't go over in this meeting. I'll have you and I, we can chat afterwards. And then get your eyes off of them and start engaging someone else.
It's fascinating watching how people react. You call them into a meeting, and some want to be there, others don't want to be there,
mm-hmm.
and a few couldn't care less. To me, it's the tone of the group leader that really sets the success of a meeting. And by tone, I mean the command. Well, you want to comment on that?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, I can even demonstrate during this, if I were to say, why would you ask that? Versus if I would say, I'm curious why you brought that up. I mean, totally mm-hmm. different in my tone, totally different in my word choice. And that's where you were talking earlier about, you know, putting your index finger on your ear, and I was talking about audio recording. That's why I think it's even more critical than ever to really pay attention to how do you sound. It's tough to evaluate our voice, our tone, if we're not getting the appropriate feedback and we're not experiencing that through the ears of our listeners.
Tell us about your book again, where people can get it.
You bet. You can find it on our website. We're easy to find. The website is Stacy with an E-Y, HANKEINC.com. It is also on Barnes & Noble website as well as Amazon.
Back to you, Dan.
Thank you. Stacy, one of the things that I've learned over the years of public speaking and trying to help people with public speaking is the realization that when we stand at a podium in front of a group of people, within moments, a glass wall comes down and separates us from the audience. And we, as the speaker, have a responsibility to break through the glass wall.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why I think some people are boring, are not effective, is because they can't break through the glass wall.
Yeah.
And I found for me the best way to break through the glass wall is to move away from the podium.
Oh, my gosh, yes. That's
move
like
out into the
basic
audience
101, right?
Mm-hmm. But you're amazed at the number of people who don't know that.
I'm amazed. I even still have, when I get to a conference site and I'm setting up, I'll have the audiovisual guys, when I ask them, you know, move the podium, can you get it off the stage or move it off to the side? And they look at me like, don't you need that? And it seems so dark ages to me. I think the other thing mm-hmm. that really helps to get people on your side is you should be greeting every person that walks in that room before you start. That is a great way for them to see you're human and you're there for them,
yeah.
not for you.
Yeah, I've done presentations to 3,000 people. That's a little tough to do, but I do. I try and meet as many as I possibly can. But I do think the idea, your suggestion of moving the podium, I think it's a great idea because it first of all, if you think about all the people that were before you and the people in the audience, their heads have been in the same position for hours upon hours. Their necks are getting frozen. By just moving a little bit, you can keep some of those people from going to sleep.
That's right.
It was a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you.
For me, it was a walk down memory lane 40, 50 mm-hmm. years ago when mm-hmm. I first started doing public speaking and radio. And I really enjoyed your insights, and I hope people will go get your book. And I want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much to both of you. Best of luck. I so appreciate your time this afternoon.
That was great. Thank you.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Our next guest that I'm really looking forward to is Karen Reynolds Sharkey. She's here from a U.S. trust, which is a division of Bank of America. They have a new survey of 248 high net worth business owners and entrepreneurs. And it's fascinating what she has to say. Karen, welcome to the program.
Oh, Don, thank you for having me on the program today.
Well, first off, tell us where the website and where people can see the survey.
Absolutely. If your audience can go to ustrust.com/business. The survey is on the website. In addition, we have a very short video that highlights some of the results from the survey also.
Well, tell us about what you do and some of the highlights of the survey.
Sure. I am the National Business Owner Strategist for U.S. Trust, and I work with our advisors around the country and our clients who are business owners and entrepreneurs to help them everywhere from startup through growth to also exiting their business. And specifically, and this is one of the highlights of the survey, you know, about 50% of business owners actually expect to take some type of action on their company over the next 3 years. Many of them are thinking about selling their business. And we will help around kind of business succession planning for the business and also estate planning for the family. There are two separate plans that business owners should consider and should have, but they are intertwined because so many of our business owners, clients, think of themselves, their business, and their family as one. So really helping them to think through the different plans that they should have in place.
Well, this is definitely an area that I'll turn over to Dan because he's been involved with this as well. Dan? It's all yours.
Thank you. Karen, thank you for joining us on the show today. I do have a question for clarification for our audience. How is U.S. Trust different than Bank of America?
Sure. U.S. Trust is the private banking arm of Bank of America. So we work with individuals and their families around their own estate plans, credit, investments on behalf of the family and the individual business owner. Bank of America is the corporation, which includes also our retail branches throughout the country, also our institutional and corporate coverage also.
And Merrill Lynch.
Yes, and Merrill Lynch.
All right. So this survey was done with how many different people? 260, did I read that right?
It's 248 business owners that we surveyed.
Okay.
190 of the business owners are still current and running operating businesses, and then 58 retired business owners.
So would you say that the people that are on your list that you sent out these survey requests, are they small business, middle market, large, or everything?
It really runs the gamut from clients, and I shouldn't say in clients, they were actually not clients. It was an independent survey that was sent out of everywhere from individual businesses with $1 million of revenue up through $100 million of revenue. So really running the gamut of small business and middle market companies.
So you talked a little bit about when you were speaking with Don about people, one of your services is to help companies sell their businesses. Given the 10,000 people a day who are retiring from the baby boomers, do you see a growing part of your business in helping those your clients sell their businesses?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we don't sell the business within U.S. Trust, within our investment bank. They will actually do the advisory work around selling a business. But to
mm-hmm.
your point, Dan, you know, more and more of the baby boomers have been running their companies for 20 or 30 years, and they're really at a fork in the road right now of thinking about what is that next step for them. It may be selling their business to a third party, either financial or strategic, or they might be transferring the company to their children to take over ownership and management of the company. And we will help them think through whichever path they're thinking about, how to kind of proceed down that path, you know, issues that we've seen with other clients that have gone down that path. So we try to share other stories and helping them prepare for that next step and also the next chapter of their life after they decide to sell or transfer the business.
From the people, the other people we've talked to on the show, one of the biggest challenges for the baby boomer in selling their business is the transition of no longer going to work on Monday morning. And do you provide any help with counseling in that area about what you're going to do next?
Sure. I think that's an important part of the discussion when a business owner is thinking about that next step. We actually have a piece that we've created called The Owner's Emotional Journey, and it's lessons learned before, during, and after the sale of the business. And to your point, Dan, you know, we do, you know, focus on what, you know, is that next chapter for the business owner. It may be that they go into a new venture. It could be we see a lot of our business owner clients want to do something philanthropically, either in their community and give back, so they might become even more active philanthropically. Sometimes they want to spend time with their family. So, again, we try to have that discussion to start preparing the business owner for that next chapter. I'll share a story with you. I had one client that said, Karen, the Monday after I sold my business, I put on my suit and realized I didn't have any place to go. And so, again, helping, you know, the business owner think through what is going to be their next chapter, what do they want to do next after they sell their business.
That's extremely important. I've been managing money for 40-some years, and now that my clients is getting older and they're now looking at retirement, one of the things we spent more time about than anything else is what are you going to do when you walk out the door for the last time from the office? And the pamphlet, the program that you mentioned about planning, is that available on your website?
Yes, The Owner's Emotional Journey that I just mentioned. And then we also have another piece called The Owner's Journey, which we created in partnership with Columbia Business School, where we profile about 8 of our clients who sold or transferred their business and lessons
right.
learned going through the process and then post. So both of those pieces are on that website that I mentioned up front.
And mention it again, please.
It's www.ustrust.com/business.
You know, Don, we need to put that on our website, that a link to that specific place. That's going to be an extremely valuable document. You know,
Dan, I'd like to jump in with a question. One of the things we've also heard in recent years in our surveys have shown is that a lot of children don't want to go into the same business as their parents were into and don't like the 24/7 of it. Have you run into that? What do you do about that?
Yeah, so we've seen just over the last couple of decades, if we were on this call in like the 1970s or 80s, about 50% of businesses would have been transferred to the next generation, to the children. We're finding now, and it came through in the survey again this year, less than 20% of children now want to take over the family business. And it could be for various different reasons. Some of them want to start their own business and the family's funding it. Some might want to have their own career outside of the family business. So there's many different reasons why, but I do think that's creating then that path, that fork in the road that I talked about earlier. It then is forcing some family businesses to go down the path then of looking to sell the business, since there's not a natural heir to come into the business, or the business might continue with non-family members as a management team then for the business.
What about ESOPs that's one, but Where do you find the people to buy businesses? We've been told that finding people to buy is also becoming a problem.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. You mentioned ESOPs. You know, ESOPs and management buyouts are definitely another alternative for an owner to consider. So therefore, kind of keeping it, you know, with the management team or the employees going forward. But if that's not an alternative that a business owner wants to kind of go down that path, again, it's looking to a third party. And so in that scenario, it would be looking to an investment bank. Like within Bank of America, we have our own investment bank. There are other boutique investment banks all throughout the United States that can help the business owner advise them on their company, where they fit in the industry, and potentially could have a discussion if their business is viable for a sale.
Back to you, Dan.
Well, I want to follow that. I have to tell you, I was blown away with the number. You're talking 20 to 25%, or the other way to look at it is probably 70 to 75% of the original owner's businesses, the family members are not interested in running them. And that's got to cause a tremendous dislocation of a lot of people in that age group when they're trying to figure out what to do when they find they're not going to find many of their friends. If they had businesses, they're going to have their children in the business. And that's got to be an emotional shock and a drain for them too.
Yes, I think a lot of business owners, you know, I've seen it again and again that they try to bring the children into the business, and they might take different steps. We have some business owners that want their children to have some external experience prior to coming to the business. Some of the kids grow up in the business. But to your point, Dan, is, you know, at some point a decision needs to be made. Do the children want to take over the business? And then we think it's very important to have communication within the family, the patriarch mm-hmm. or matriarch, with the children as to what the children's goals are and do they want to be part of the family business going forward. And if the decision is made that it's just not a good fit and therefore, again, no natural heir to kind of take over the business, then there are some hard decisions that are going to need to be made about what is the next step then for the owner and for the business. Obviously, there's employees, there's a management team that can be impacted from all these decisions. So early planning and communication is very key.
Do you find again, I'm still blown away by your numbers. It would seem to me that there's got to be some what's the word I want? There's got to be some emotional significant for the owner, founder, significant emotional attachment to the business. And when he finds out or she finds out that the children don't want to run the business, I would think that that would create a great deal of emotional distress for the founder, but it may also cause family problems?
I think Thanksgiving dinner discussion could be interesting, in some of these situations. Yes. But if you think about the alternative, right, is potentially having a child who really doesn't want to be part of the business, doesn't want to be a CEO, maybe wants to pursue a different career, and if they're forced into running a business, the question is, are they with the right leader? You know, going back to, there's a management team, there's employees, they want to make sure the leader in charge, you know, has the vision and wants to be there and drive the company forward and grow the company. And you want to make sure you have the right person in that seat. So that might mean that maybe even the son or the daughter maybe has a role in one of the divisions, but maybe isn't the CEO of the company going forward. And so that goes back to that decision-making process as to what is the goals, and, you know, really having that communication with the children who are, you know, sometimes adult children, to say, you know, kind of what do you want to do and what is the right decision for this, you know, kind of company, because you want the company to continue to be viable and growing over time.
Is that a question more than for Thanksgiving dinner? Is that a question that is hard for the founder, the matriarch, to ask? Because maybe they don't want to hear the answer.
It can be. And that's what we work a lot with our clients in, helping them through some of these discussions and the communications. You know, we'll sometimes run family retreats where we're helping kind of some of the dialogue around the family, but also the business, and kind of, again, mm-hmm. what's their goals over the next 1, 3, 5, 10 years, and helping them with these types of discussions. Because, as you said, Dan, sometimes it's hard for, you know, someone to bring this up, or, you know, they kind of push it off, hoping that, you know, it'll just kind of all work out. Again, I can't stress enough early communication and planning. There can be bumps along the road, but at least if you have a plan in place, because the other thing we haven't really talked about is sometimes things unexpectedly happen. And if something unexpectedly happens to the matriarch or patriarch, is the business set then for a quick transition if that had to happen?
So it sounds to me, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but it sounds to me is that as I've seen in my practice, those kind of difficult decisions get put off. And then because there was no planning in advance, even though you might be yelling at them to get it done and trying to do everything you can to get it done, they refuse to do it. Then you're doing something in crisis. And I've been through that with some clients. I would like to move on just a little bit and ask you another question about the survey. Are there other issues that are dominate the survey that we should know about?
Yeah, I think another just interesting kind of aspect of the survey was, giving back. And, you know, how many of the business owners feel that they're giving back either through creating jobs and the economic opportunities for their employees, but they're also supporting their employees through potentially volunteerism, you know, matching gifts for their employees, or they might even have a foundation set up within the company. And that it was an important part for a lot of our business owners, and what we found was over 70% of the business owners that responded actually came from philanthropic families themselves, and it was a part of the way they thought about their business also.
I'm curious, we just started before the break talking about some of the other issues. What other issues do you think I should ask? How long have you been doing the survey, and are there new things coming in, old things dropping off, trends changing, getting stronger, getting weaker? What can you tell us about that?
Sure. So we've been doing the survey for many, many years, but over the last couple of years, we've done a specific carve out around business owners. And something else, Dan and Don, that you might find of interest is we really took a look this year at millennial business owners versus all business owners, and we cut the kind of survey that way. And what we're finding is a lot of younger entrepreneurs are starting their businesses early. For example, right out of business school, or they are starting it, maybe they've had a corporate job for a few years and then are starting their own company, versus, say, some of their mature kind of business owners that might have worked in a corporate kind of job for a little longer before starting their company. And in addition to that, what we're finding is, again, how are they funding themselves? And a lot of the millennial entrepreneurs are funding themselves by, you know, inheritance, savings. They are taking, you know, credit card advances to kind of get themselves started. And then many of them are then looking for outside funding earlier than what we found with some of our more mature business owners and when they started taking in outside funding.
I wonder if that we've been doing this show now for almost 8 months, and one of the reoccurring themes that we hear all the time is with young people, they started their business on the internet. The cost or the entry to barrier to entry is much lower using the internet, and I wonder if many of the people that you're talking about are getting into their businesses because they can get into them at the internet at much lower cost.
Yeah, it's a great point, Dan. We don't have that specific data, but to your point, I think the barriers to entry are a lot lower now than probably 10, 20, 30 years ago. So as a result, it is easier if you have your vision and your business plan, you know, how do you get to market, you know, and what is your clients? And the internet has provided, obviously, a source to connect with a lot more people quicker, you know, nationally or internationally, depending upon your products. So I think that is a very good point.
Karen, I have a question. Are you seeing more women reaching this point than men over the past 20 years?
And reaching, I'm sorry, what point?
Reaching the point of starting to think about retirement, in effect being successful, now deciding there was a time to end this this phase of their careers, or is that still a little bit in the future?
I think some of that will still be in the future. We definitely have some great success stories of women who have built up very successful businesses and have exited just like their male counterparts. An interesting statistic about, you know, over 40% of businesses now are either solo or co-owned, you know, by women. And a lot of times it's a husband-wife team or two partners that are still growing the business. But I think it does, whether you're male or female, it just sometimes you get to a point that you start saying, okay, what is going back to that next chapter? And what do I want to do next? And everybody has their own kind of timeline in their head. But we've seen it work very well across the spectrum of male and female-owned businesses.
Well, I want to just follow up on that. The most dangerous part about having a couple running a business is if they decide to separate or divorce. I'm going down to Atlanta to do an expert witness on just that point. Are you finding that as well? Are you seeing couples breaking up as they reach certain points in their success story?
I don't have a lot of data points to back that one up, but I think like anything else, if you are running a business and you are, you know, kind of married, it can be a very good thing or it can be detrimental. So again, it's just about communication of continuing to run the business professionally when you're, you know, at the business, and then there will be another discussion that obviously can happen on the home front.
Okay, so I want to go and look at something from the standpoint of Don and myself. We both consider ourselves serial entrepreneurs. We are both past 70, and yet we are both actively pursuing totally new business ventures. And I'm wondering if there is a change. You know, you talked about people selling their businesses or wanting to move on to do other things. I wonder if there are people in their what's supposed to be their retirement years are starting over again, starting new business.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I think some of our clients, you know, might take some time off after selling their business, but goes back to your question earlier is then what's the next chapter? And, you know, whether, again, it's starting new ventures like yourself, and kind of, some of our clients are investing in other companies in their community because they've obviously created some liquidity if they sold their company. So a lot of times they become angel investors and will invest in other companies. And a lot of times they'll either sit on the board or just be part of an advisory council for that company because they still have that passion that they want to kind of give back. And being able to help grow something. So we're definitely seeing that trend of business owners selling and then going into some new ventures. Again, whether they are going to be managing and owning a company or contributing to other companies. As I said earlier, too, we're seeing a lot of business owners are also starting to look philanthropically and how they can give their time and energy and kind of skills to different philanthropic organizations. So we're seeing also many entrepreneurs going down that avenue, too. And it doesn't have to be an all or nothing. I think having a portfolio of different activities for a lot of business owners is very helpful and keeps them kind of their hands in a lot of different different areas.
Do you help those people who are looking for something to do, help them find something to do?
We are definitely always helping clients think through what that next step can be. And sometimes we can provide some introductions to some folks if they want introductions. A lot of these business owners are very well known in their communities already. So they already know a lot of the different kind of networks. But we're always happy to provide also introductions if we can.
Karen, can you give us your website again?
Sure. It's www.ustrust.com/business.
I'm curious, Karen, about the about what you think is going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years. Are there things that you're planning for that you think are likely to emerge over the next 5 to 10 years in your business?
Sure. I think we're going to see a lot of the continuation of what we're seeing already is, baby boomers, business owners, starting to make that decision on what is that next chapter for them. And again, we help our clients every day, help them think through that, both from a business point of view and also for their family, because, it's an important component when you're running a family enterprise. But I think what we're also going to see is millennial entrepreneur business owners, also a lot of them potentially leaving their business and going on to a new venture. So you're going to have a whole population of entrepreneur business owners that are really kind of taking a look at what is that next chapter. And no matter where they are in their life cycle, they are kind of considering, do I acquire, do I sell, do I pass on my business? The key thing I would just highlight is just having a succession plan and an estate plan kind of in place. Plan early. Things can change over time. Plans can change over time. But if you have a plan in place, then you're the one in control that can then modify it versus some outside factor coming in that effectively makes you make a decision.
Yeah. I want to close on this this issue of planning with one of the last question. I always found that if I did a financial plan for a client, and I had it all bound up and used a service, and I would sit there and talk to the client about the plan, unless I really pushed it, set on the coffee table and be turned into a coffee table book. How do you motivate your clients to actually do what you're recommending for them?
Yeah, so I think the key part to your point is you don't just write the plan and then put it on a shelf, and leave it. It has to be an active plan. So what we do with our clients is we'll do check-ins periodically, every quarter, biannually. Again, I mentioned those kind of family retreats we do before. A lot of times once a year we're getting together with our clients who are families and kind of talking through the plan. Are there adjustments that need to be made to the plan? Are there new members of the family that need to be considered as part of the plan? So it's something that will continue to evolve over time, and it just doesn't sit on a shelf, gaining dust and never gets pulled off the shelf. It has to be a living plan that works for you, your family, and your business.
So in closing, I want you to go back and tell the audience the name of that booklet you have, those two booklets that you have, and the website so we can give them an opportunity to get a head start on planning.
Absolutely. So the website is www.ustrust.com/business. The two different pieces, one's called the owner's journey, and the other one's called the emotional owner's journey. And then in addition to that, the survey that Dan and Don have been talking about is called the Wealth and Worth Survey, which is also on that website.
We've been talking with Karen Reynolds-Sharkey, National Business Owner Strategy Executive at U.S. Trust. Karen, thank you so much for being with us. A link to your study will be on our website, www.recalculating.biz, tonight.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I enjoyed being on the program.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.